Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Today's topic area is part of our Clinician Series podcast. In our regular podcast, we provide the coverage of a mental health topic of interest, and we find ourselves typically focused on the why behind or the why that drives the work being done in a specific area. The Clinician Series, however, is taking the discussion of topic areas a few steps further, specifically talking with experts not just about the why of their area of expertise, but we'll dive into a more practical, more hands-on, experiential understanding of the what and the how regarding the application of various therapeutic techniques, strategies, and constructs that we'll be presenting. The goal of the Clinician Series is to take our listeners behind the therapy door, to provide a look at and develop an appreciation for what actually occurs in the therapy session, including what gets said, patients' reactions, and the dynamic between the therapist-patient that can occur during the therapy hour.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. I'm joined today by Dr. Aaron Elmore, a psychologist whose practice focuses on children, teens, and young adults. She's based out of San Diego, California. She's also one of the test prep experts in the broader Triad family. Aaron, welcome today.
Thank you for having me.
So nice to be here with you. You know, in our last podcast together on parenting, you and I got to explore the various aspects of parenting and encourage parents to adopt a boldness in their parenting and to develop a confidence in this role of being a parent. We both know and we talked about how parenting takes a ton of love, but it also requires a grit and a backbone for when things get relationally tough. Aaron, I know you primarily treat children and teens around issues of behavior like acting out or anger or defiance, or maybe some of the emotional struggles they're going through like anxiety or depression, maybe kind of shutting down or maybe going through some grief or loss or some transitions in their life, and also some of the relationships in their lives that are important, like family conflicts and tension and some of the social skills that they're trying to develop as young adults. And I know you focus primarily on the disruption in interpersonal and social functioning. So given this population that you're working with and your focus, set us up for what a typical client that walks through your door looks like and how you see and address their presenting problems that they're sharing with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so families often come to me because they have some concern about their child or even maybe a young adult. And this could be the teenager being really disrespectful, maybe withdrawing and not communicating with the parents anymore or the family right. In general. They may have concerns about, like you said, anxiety or depression, or maybe the family's going through some transition like a divorce or a loss and there's just a lot of family conflict. Mm-hmm. And the way I'm trained is a bit systemic, which just means that I focus a lot on what's behind the problem. So obviously one goal is to help whatever the concern is that they're coming into therapy for, but I also focus a lot on why is that problem there, right? So are there generational dynamics? Are there family dynamics? So the way I work really is very inclusive of the parents, which is hence bold parenting. Sometimes it seems like the problem really is with the child or the teen, and that can mm-hmm. happen. Obviously, they have things going on in their life and they may need some support. But often when a child or a teen is the quote unquote problem, that actually is really just a symptom of something going on within the family unit itself. So I like to sort of treat the family as a client as well.
I really like that. A lot of times when people come in or as practitioners, we refer to who's the identified patient.
Yes.
You know, and it's easy sometimes to see the acting out child or the withdrawn child as the one that needs to be fixed. But what I love about your systemic approach and the way you're describing it right now is that problem is occurring within a larger context, whether it's just the family right now itself, or maybe some external circumstances, or maybe even some generational themes like you talked about a moment ago. So you're talking about gathering information. Are there some techniques in the first assessment or first engagement with the child, the young adult that and the family that you typically find yourself focusing on?
The first engagement, there's a few goals. One is to make sure that my training is a really good fit for what they need. And secondly, to make sure that the family or child is comfortable with me, because obviously it's very relational treatment right. therapy. So you want to make sure that they're comfortable as well. They get a say in if they want to keep working with me or not. But also I'm really assessing for what is that root problem. And one way to do that is to pay attention not only to the background information that I'm getting, mm-hmm. like facts and history and when things started and all of that, but also pay attention to how I feel interacting with them, because yes. how they're making me feel is probably how they make each other feel. And paying attention to just their dynamics in general, like how close do they sit next to each other on the couch and who's making eye contact with whom and who's not there, right? Like often there's one parent that's a lot more involved, yep. which could be fine, but sometimes that's a sign that we need to pull the other parent in to balance out these family dynamics. So I'm really just paying attention to the whole totality of that first appointment. Really? And sometimes it even starts with the phone call, right? You can learn a lot about somebody yeah. in just 5 minutes on the phone.
Absolutely. So there's a lot going on, even if it's nonverbal, but there's a lot of information communicating to you, not just about how you feel in the process, but also what you notice between them, who's talking first or the type of way they address each other, eye contact, way they're seating, et cetera. That's very informative. Well, in terms of an actual session, let's give people an idea. What's an actual session look like? How's it structured?
Yeah, so a typical therapy session is about 45 minutes. And I read somewhere that they did studies on this and found out that the effectiveness of therapy is the same for 45 minutes as 60. So I think that's why we've come up with 45 minutes, and that allows yes. the clinician time to, you know, process what just happened, maybe go to the restroom afterwards. So that's sure. that's why they're 45 minutes.
Keep yourself healthy.
Yeah, yeah. But with younger yeah. children, they usually can't pay attention quite that long, or if you have a child mm-hmm. who has ADHD. So the younger the child, the more often I check in with the parents. So typically mm-hmm. I'll do 15-minute check-in with the parents and then 30 minutes with the child. But for older teens or young adults, they usually get the full time themselves, 45 minutes, and then I'll have a separate parent session to check in and process what's going on about once a month. And often I'll do full family sessions or maybe a parent and a child session, just kind of whatever's necessary to help further the treatment goal. Sometimes that's to gain insight from a different family member. Yeah. Or sometimes it's if there's a relational conflict between the child or teen and a certain parent, so we can really engage deeper with that.
When you're meeting in that way and when you're considering the process around a therapy session, how do you think about things like goal setting? Your therapeutic approach is pretty clear. Maybe you might even include maybe some other therapeutic components. And how do you find yourself being able to engage the parents and the children together in this process?
Yeah, it's pretty individualized. So it's hard to come up with like a general mm-hmm. way it usually goes. You know, every family is so different. But yes. as far as agreeing on goals, usually the parents in particular have a short-term goal that they want to see happen. That's the reason they're coming to me, right? There's some kind of crisis happening. The child really needs a better sense of coping or communication. So that's usually the first step of engagement, is having everyone agree on, all right, how are you guys going to know this is working and how are we going to see progress pretty quickly? And obviously that helps them stay invested, because we don't want to pay a provider when we're not seeing results right
sure,
away.
Sure.
So I think of it as short term. An example of that could be, okay, if we have a teen who's cutting, let's reduce the cutting. Or if we have yes. a family that's just yelling at each other all the time, nothing's going to be accomplished. So let's right. create better communication. And then once that short-term goal is met, we can sink into more long-term goals. And that's where my sense of, okay, why did this happen in the first really place good. Comes in, right? So get to the root of where is that coming from? What was sustaining that problematic behavior? And that's a lot more where the family involvement comes in usually, or we'll have more parent-child sessions, because usually you're adjusting some family dynamics or just giving parents more tools, different tools. And obviously still supporting the teen or child and whatever their new coping is during that time. So it's really a coming together of the progress so far, and then going a little deeper to make sure the family and teen can maintain this progress long beyond the end of therapy.
Really good. Really good. You're talking about maybe some other techniques where you might even allow the teen to lead, or maybe even mm-hmm. some role playing where there's a broader perspective on both parts that gets shared, or maybe even some real time arguments. You might even bring that right into therapy and say, hey, let's try and work this out. This for me is where therapy really becomes alive. So maybe the teen's taking a lead, or some perspective gained, or some arguments like we're talking about. Share about some of those ideas.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's important to note too that there's so many different ways therapists are trained, right? Like I'm mentioning, I have a bit of a systemic background. Some people focus on other ways of improving symptoms. But the main thing the research shows that's important is that that therapist is empathic and that the client can trust them. So, yes. You know, for the families out there thinking of trying to find someone, it's less about how does this person work and more about, well, yes, make sure they're trained, but also make sure that there is a good relational connection there and empathy there. And that's going to be the most effective. But, you know, to your point, a lot of the ways I've been trained, some of the things that I use are, I think of it as a combination of an interpersonal approach and then a combination of a cognitive behavioral therapy approach. And I'll kind of explain those two. So the interpersonal part comes from more of a traditional psychodynamic orientation. And what that really means is that I'm paying attention to what's going on relationally, not just what we're talking about. So, you know, paying attention to the process, if you will, instead of just the content. So an example would be if there's a teenager I'm working with who is bipolar and has that very up and down mood, you know, very depressed and then very intense manic mood, I'll actually notice that often in the family, there's a parallel process where the family has that exact same pattern. So there'll be weeks where they argue and everything seems like it's all falling apart and they want to schedule an extra session. But by the time we get to that session, 2 days later, they forgot why they're coming in and they're completely fine. So it's paying attention to not just the problem, if you will, but also like what's going on in the process that's feeding this problem. Or even more personally, sometimes I'll pay attention to what I'm feeling from a patient. So a teen may say what I want to hear, but they're making me feel really angry for some reason. And so I'll pay attention to that and ask, are you feeling angry? Like, what's going on for you? And often there's just, you can sink deeper into the problem because of that interpersonal approach.
Just a little side note around that. I love the way you use yourself as one of the therapeutic tools as well, whether it's your own counter-transferential reactions or whether it's a projective identification where you're identifying something that doesn't fit with you, but you use that as a, hey, I wonder if you are maybe experiencing something here, and to begin to broaden an awareness of and an understanding of what's going on in those moments at a process level. I love that approach.
Yes. And that's a lot where the arguing in real time comes in handy, right? Because you may have, I'm thinking of an example of maybe a teen says like, dad, you don't ever listen to me, right? And the dad is complaining, well, she's so disrespectful. Like, I'm not going to listen to her when she's disrespectful. So I'll have them argue in front of me. Yes. And all that's really happening is that the teen is sharing her feelings and the dad is focused on the content instead of the feelings, which is fine. But she feels misunderstood because he's not sinking into validating her emotions. So then she becomes disrespectful and then they just spiral, right? But by having them argue in front of me and me paying attention to the process of what's happening instead of just what they're saying, we can help connect them, which is really what they're looking for.
Really like that. What you're talking about here too, just to kind of name it together, there's always two levels of communication going on, aren't there? There's the content, it's the stuff. And then there's the process. What's going on at a deeper level that we may not be aware of? And what I love that you're raising is you help them not understand just the content, but what's going on underneath at a deeper level, oftentimes unconsciously, maybe it's a need-based or need-driven, frustration-driven set of experiences someone's going on, but they never really get a chance to focus on that. More times than not, they're not aware that it's even going on.
Exactly.
And so we get stuck on content, you know, hoping that the answer is up here, but it never is. And what I understand is that content is only going to be as successful as the process between us is understood, both the within work going on within me and then how I bring it in the between work between us. So I love this idea of helping them understand not just what the content is, but what it means to each of them to grow that understanding in a kind of almost an empathically attuned way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well said. And then the second part of what I do, so that's the interpersonal part. The second part is the cognitive behavioral therapy part, which is a pretty well-known approach. It's called CBT. I think of it as more practical, right? So the interpersonal is the process, the relational connection. But a lot of times with teens and kids, you need practical solutions and practical advice on what to do, how to manage tantrums, how to get them to talk to you. So that's where the CBT part comes in for me, where I can help parents come up with a structured plan, a structured set of rewards or consequences, and I can help the teen or child come up with their own way to cope better. So CBT, the whole theory is how our behaviors, emotions, and thoughts are connected to each other. So becoming more aware of that really gives the child or teen, and even adults can use this too, more awareness of, okay, when I say this, why am I saying that? When I act this way, what am I really feeling? So that increased awareness, there's a lot of tools that come in handy to shift how we're responding or reacting in situations, which is really a lot of what families need, I think, from their teens and their kids.
I really like that idea of increasing our awareness and our mindfulness in a moment. Oftentimes, the moments don't change, but what changes is how I come into that moment with a greater awareness of myself, a greater appreciation for the other person, a more mindful approach of being able to kind of slow down or understand something that maybe I didn't understand before at a process level, not just the content. The content sometimes is just a form of delivery that we're trying to get, you know, our needs met through. But if we can understand things at a deeper level, you talk about oftentimes using role plays to gain perspective. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is something that, I mean, I understand, but most clients will roll their eyes at, like, oh, I don't want to do this. It's so uncomfortable. But you learn so much by embodying either the problem or trying. It's a different way to kind of express what you need. Yeah. So sometimes I'll have, you know, the parents act like their teenager to really show their perception of how disrespectful they are and what's going on. And you can have some fun with it, right? Obviously, they're going to be more dramatic. And then the teen, they pretend they don't like it, but they usually like to kind of role play their parents being too harsh or too whatever. And so that way, it's just a fun way to kind of externalize the tension so that all of it's on the table and people can understand each other's perspectives better. And then we can, as a team, discuss, okay, you know, was that accurate? Was that not accurate? What about that needs to be changed? How did you feel when they responded to you this way? So it just really helps bring the parent and child or the family together because you can empathize more when they're role playing you. And sometimes I'll role play just with the teen, right? Like if there's something they really need to tell their parents that they're afraid to tell their parents, or I'm encouraging them, like, you know, I will tell them this, but it really should come from you. Let's figure out how you could tell them. So I'll pretend to be the teen and they'll pretend to give the worst answers they can imagine from their parent. And we'll reverse that's roles because they've heard me sort of say it in a way that's constructive. So then they can practice saying it in their own words. So there's a lot of ways you can use role play just to sort of distance from the problem. And then you can think more clearly.
Really good. I know oftentimes parents need some help crafting some understanding of things going on, maybe even some parental skills. Share a little bit more about the parental support that you might find parents requiring in order to kind of step into this role effectively. Yeah. What do you find?
Well, I really believe parents are doing the best they can, right? I mean, it's not easy to raise a kid the second you figure out one thing, they've grown up and you need to figure out something else. Right. And not to mention, we're in a completely different time right now with social media and technology, and nobody knows how to parent children during this time. So I feel really empathic towards parents, and I think parenting's hard. And so a lot of times I'll meet with parents one-on-one and just ask, like, how are you doing with this? How's your stress level? Make sure that they have their own support. My primary role is really for the patient, or whether that's the teen or the child, but I do provide parent support in the sense of helping them help their child. So I'll share insights I've gained about their child from therapy. We'll brainstorm ideas of, okay, what have you tried that works? What have you tried that isn't working? Really try and help them come up with more of an individualized plan for new techniques they can try that are realistic given their time constraints or other children in the home and the stresses that they're under. But a lot of it, I think, is just, you know, letting the parents know this is hard and there's no set way to do this. But a lot of what's really important is just that the parent can sink into their own process, right? And realize their own reaction so that they can then create space and interactions with their child that are more productive and more helpful. So I guess in a sense, that's where the relational approach comes into with the parents.
Yes. I really like that, you know, support you're giving them in a way that's encouraging and normalizing and validating that what they're going through is a pretty significant process and they're brave to take it on. And it is not an easy one. And I also know that, you know, part of some of the parents that I work with, for some of them, it's, you know, learning how to develop some emotional muscle, learning to kind of up their own personal parental game, if you will, where maybe in their families of origin, understanding, you know, their own parenting model, what they received. And more times than not, like you said, you know, we're all doing as parents the best we can. And oftentimes what we find is that we do what we know. What was done for us is what we give. You know, what exactly. we received, we give, and without even thinking about it. So what you're talking about is kind of making the unconscious conscious. And what is it like for you to parent? Maybe in terms of what about, you know, a child that might need some affection? What does that pull for you? Is that easy? Is that hard? Do you get uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. You get anxious? Mm-hmm. Or how about communication? What's communication like in your family growing up? And what is it like now when in this society we're required to speak and communicate very differently with our families and with each other? Or what happens when conflict gets kicked up in your family? What I know as a, you know, as a child growing up, you know, parents sitting in front of me, is conflict in your family was very scary. So maybe for you, setting boundaries with your child and risking them rebelling is very scary. So maybe you take kind of a laissez-faire approach and you're afraid to put boundaries, and now the child's running all over you looking for boundaries, you know, to feel safe. So what I'm appreciating is that it sounds like you also are helping the parent appreciate some of their own upbringing and how that impacts this, but also what are some skill areas, whether it's communication, boundary setting, self-soothing, self-management, that's also an important part of their role.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's where that bold parenting term comes in. These are the sessions that I really encourage, that bold parenting. So it's, you're looking for that balance of warmth and structure. And some families have both, but they may be a little out of balance. Some families are really missing one just because of their background, like you explained. I don't think it's something intentional. It's just, we do the best we can with what we know.
Yes.
So a lot of it is just supportive education and then helping them come up with examples and ideas of how they could help that balance out in their specific family.
I really like that. I think that awareness allows us to, you know, we have to put down rules, and we talk about discipline versus punishment. Discipline is I'm doing something for you. Punishment is I'm doing something to you. And everything that a parent does, typically a loving parent, is in the service of their child's best interest, you know, putting something in place to help shape and mold and help them, you know, achieve and become the person, you know, they have the potential to realize. So the idea that you're talking about this relational approach, and where there's a relationship along with the rules, so there was a psychologist, Dr. James Dobson, who used to say, rules without a relationship equals rebellion.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the relationship being such an important piece of this. And out of that comes this structure of how we're going to parent and raise this child in our home.
Exactly.
So as we talk about that, let's talk about the process, you know, and how you measure progress taking place and kind of how you check in with that. What's it look like?
Yeah. So therapy is a constantly evolving process. You know, people may come in with one problem and think that that's really the root of it. But then when we dig deeper, there's so much more there. Or sometimes it's pretty straightforward. And after a few weeks, they're doing well. So I'm constantly reevaluating and reassessing, both from the teen or child's perspective of how they're doing, but also what the parents are seeing. Because obviously they're there 24/7 and I'm only there one time a week. So I think of myself as a team with the parents. So we're always checking in. And as I mentioned before, that's pretty natural with younger kids, because the parents will usually bring them into session. Or nowadays on telehealth, I'll make sure to check in with the parents, at least in the beginning, to see how things are going. But I usually make a habit of checking in with parents about once a month of older teens and older students. And that way we have a set time to see if there's any extra concerns, or if we both agree that things are progressing well. And also, the older the child is, the more often I encourage them to communicate directly with their parent, not about the therapy updates, but obviously if there are things that need to be talked about, I try and encourage maybe me and the teen together to talk to the parent instead of me going above their head all the time.
Yes.
So, you know, I take the age into account a lot when it comes to updates. But really, I mean, we say success is when the goal has been met, right? So it's when the client and parent and myself agree that we don't have any other goals to work on and things are going pretty well. We actually, you know this, Fran, but we actually have an ethical mandate to make ourselves available to other people that have needs, instead of keeping therapy going on and on and on indefinitely if we don't have a goal or a plan, even though we would probably love to still see our clients and our families longer. So I'm really always looking towards, all right, is this productive? Are we getting somewhere? And I think, you know, I think it's good to note that therapy is really a resource people can come back to in the future. So especially with kids and teens, often, you know, I'll see someone as a child and then a few years go by and then something happens and they want to come back as a teenager. And I think adults may do that as well, right? We all go through different seasons where we feel fine and we want to try these new coping skills on our own. And that works great for a while, but you can always, you know, come back or find a new therapist if needed.
You bet. So, good therapy at some point does come to an end. It's we're there to get something as a resource, and we're getting to learn new skills, self-awareness, communication, all those things. So at some point it does come to an end. Good therapy does come to an end. We get to say a goodbye. And I know that bringing therapy to a good close is as important as the therapy itself. In fact, a planned ending is a very therapeutic part of the treatment itself. How do you think about closure and a therapeutic ending to the good work that you and your patients have done together?
Yes, I think it's so important. I think especially working with younger people, this is such a novel concept to most teens and kids, is the idea of saying goodbye is important. Yeah. Because so much of our culture is just so quick, and you can just log off of something or just block someone or just, disentangle yourself, and you don't have to communicate why or process those feelings. So I really think, and there's a lot of research that supports this too, that how you end therapy can be very healing and can kind of bookmark and seal, I think, a lot of that healing if it's done well. And I don't think our culture is very good at healthy goodbyes anymore. No. So I usually, it's quite common that I'll just have people, maybe I've been seeing for years, they'll just email me and say, hey, I think I'm fine, not coming in anymore. Or parents will say, oh, now that we're back at school, we don't want to come in anymore. And it's, it's kind of how we treat dentists or, other professionals, which I understand it, but I am often educating my clients of, okay, that's fine. Absolutely fine is your choice, but let's have at least one more session to process your progress, to like bookmark your success. Let me give you some tips of what I think you can keep working on. Let's discuss signs for when you might want to come back to therapy. And because the whole thing is a relationship, I really like on the last session, no matter what age my client is, to share kind of some of my feelings of like, hey, I'm going to miss you. And these are some things that will make me remember you. And the younger the client, sometimes we'll exchange something so they can remember me. Like maybe we'll write each other a card or make each other an art project and they get to take it home. Kids are really into snack parties. So often I'll have a pre-planned, pizza and cupcake party with them. Good. So, it's, some way to really celebrate. You've done a lot of good work and you were important to me. I hope I was important to you. And, I wish you well.
It's a meaningful relationship. And what I love is that you're being intentional about carving out the necessary time to honor and respect the good work that was done and the relationship that was formed. The last research I saw is about 73% of folks that come into therapy to see us come back at some point in their life. Mm-hmm. They get to come in, understand the resource it is, the relationship that can be formed, the self that can be better understood, things achieved that maybe they hadn't been achieving before. So I love that closure because I think what it does, it allows a future consideration to be made when other life, issues or developmental tasks at that stage of age comes up. So I think that's
exactly
perfect to have good endings like that. I know we're kind of coming to a close here, but give us some resources that you'd recommend for us to have access to and you find helpful.
Yeah. So a general resource would be APA.org, the American Psychological Association, and they have plenty of resources for therapists, clinicians, but also for parents, for people that are searching for a therapist or just want to learn more about psychology in general. There's a website called psychologytoday.com, which is a really nice directory of therapists in your area. So you can search insurance or topic or age or anything, religious background, whatever you're really looking for.
Yeah.
I have a website and there's a page specifically for parents with a lot of books to read or tips how to know if your child needs therapy. So that's dr, as in Dr. Erin Elmore.com, and there's a / for parents. And then also, I really like books by Dr. Daniel Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. He's a really, really renowned researcher, and I believe he's a neuropsychologist, actually, who talks a lot about the developing brain in children and tips for how to parent kids. It's a little nerdy, but it's interesting if that's what you're looking for.
Really good. Well, I know there's no relationship in our lives that is more important than the one between parents and their children. And Erin, I thank you so much for joining us today and giving us a view into what therapy looks like and can look like with children and their families. Appreciate you being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Nice to have you. And for those listening in, thanks so much for joining us. We'll look forward to seeing you next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.